It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to more than 500,000 registered off-road vehicles, more than any other state. That includes all-terrain vehicles, or ATVs, and utility terrain vehicles, or UTVs.
And newly released numbers from the State Department of Natural Resources show most of the 29 people killed so far this year in crashes were not wearing seatbelts or helmets and had never completed an off-highway vehicle safety course.
Jake Holzclaw is a conservation warden with the Wisconsin DNR, where he oversees the off-highway vehicle program. He joins us now for a look at ATV and UTV safety in Wisconsin. Jake, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Glad to be with you.
ATVs, they've evolved over the decades. UTVs came on the scene with people sitting side by side. What are the capabilities and uses of these machines?
Well, it's a big variety. I think most folks nowadays are using them recreationally. They're using them on the trails around the state. They're using them on the road routes. But they're also used around farms, different properties around the state for utility purposes. So I know folks will use them on the ice for ice fishing, and there's a wide variety of reasons folks are going to have these machines.
And you've seen some growing numbers of the registrations for these off-road vehicles?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the last 5 years have probably been the biggest uptick in registrations, particularly on the UTV side. The UTVs are just becoming very popular. If I think for most people, they're more comfortable, they're more convenient. I mean, you have enclosed cabs, some of them have heat and air conditioning. And so, plus they can haul more if you're looking at them as purely a utility vehicle around the farm or around the back 40. They can haul pretty heavy loads. They can tow trailers. And so, yeah, they become very popular.
Why is Wisconsin reporting what seems like a high number of crashes compared to any other state?
Well, it's hard to say. I think there's a lot of factors here. Like you mentioned earlier, we do have the greatest number of registered machines that we're aware of any state in the country. So the sport's very popular, and the more people that you have involved in it, unfortunately, there is going to be the more chance that they could be involved in some serious incidents. But, that's something that we're really focused on, is that safety aspect.
People born before 1988, they aren't required to take a safety course for UTV, ATV operation. What do these numbers tell you by way of, fatalities and people who have taken a course versus not taken a course?
Yeah, so what we're seeing is a pretty interesting trend. It's pretty telling, and that's that the majority of our folks that are involved in fatal crashes or serious injury crashes have not completed a safety course of any kind. And like you said, folks that were born before January 1st of 1988, they're not required to take that course, but everybody after that date and time is required to take that course to operate on public lands and trails. So I think there's definitely a connection there.
What is the reason for that year, 1988? And do you foresee that changing at all to make these courses more of a stipulation in order to ride these vehicles?
Yeah, the reason for that year is my understanding, and this is before my time in the seat, but they had to pick a time frame back when the law went into effect. So they had to pick a date where that started. And that January 1st, 1988 date was picked. The idea then is that eventually everybody will have to complete that course. It's going to take a number of years, but we already have adults now, folks in their 30s that are required to take the class. So it's that's the idea behind it, is that eventually everybody will have to take it. And then it's basically considered your, quote, driver's license to operate an ATV or a UTV.
How does alcohol impairment affect what you're seeing in these numbers?
Well, it does. It affects it about 40 to 50%, depending on the year, maybe even sometimes trending a little bit higher. We're looking at that, we look at the fatalities, and 40 to 50% are going to have alcohol or some kind of drug involved in that fatality. And so it just is a really good reminder to folks that just like motor vehicles, just like cars and trucks, your best practice is to wait to drink alcohol until you're done riding for the day.
I've heard you say the word trend here a couple times. I'm wondering, how are this year's number of fatalities so far comparing to past years of Wisconsin data? Do you see any trends emerging?
Well, the one I compared this year's numbers to last year. So in 2025, around the same time frame, we had 26 fatalities. And now this year, we're trending closer to 30. So we are a little bit ahead, unfortunately, of last year. And it's hard to say why that is. I mean, we've definitely had wardens and deputies out there working the trails and trying to keep people safe and making those contacts and making those educational stops and issuing citations when need be. It's like I said earlier, it's very popular. It's a very popular sport. And so us just trying to get the word out there, like even talking on your show here today, this morning, just letting more people be aware that these machines can be very dangerous if folks don't have the right training and they don't have the right safety equipment.
Jake, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jake Holzclaw is a conservation warden with the Wisconsin DNR, where he oversees the off-highway vehicle program, talking about fatal ATV and UTV crashes in Wisconsin so far this year. Now for a look at efforts to educate Wisconsin riders on safety, we're joined by Randy Harden, president of the Wisconsin ATV UTV Association. Randy, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
What kind of work does your association do to help prevent these crashes and fatalities?
Yeah, our organization, you know, working in consultation with Jake and his team and other sheriff's departments, we really focus on communicating to the masses, if you will, through our clubs. We have about 125 to 130 local chapters. Many of them have safety instructors. We have our trail ambassador program. We're out on the trails and route systems doing our welcome centers. So we're trying to take that effective communication down at the rider level. It's disappointing when we see these numbers because really, as Jake said, the solutions are fairly simple, but people have to want to make some slight changes in their riding habits and their thought process of wearing seatbelts. And although it's not required by law to wear helmets once you're 18, it's sure recommended. And then getting training. And a lot of the folks, Beatrice, you know, you talked about the 1988 date for the younger generation, mm-hmm. but older folks that have come in their 50s, 60s, 70s, they may be the first time that they're doing an off-highway experience in an off-highway vehicle. So we have a different approach when we're trying to reach that segment versus the younger crowd. So it's a combination of things.
You mentioned volunteer trail ambassadors. What is their role? What do they do?
Yeah, we're out interacting with the riders. We do that through, like I said, actual, you would call it a patrol. We're not law enforcement, but we're out and about. We're highly visible, vests on, often stopped at a corner somewhere, or we have a large trailer that's visible. We have easy up pop-ups, and we offer, you know, where to ride, ask questions, that kind of stuff. So people come in and ask that question. It's really a good casual context to get into the conversations we need. And our goal is hopefully to help them spread the word with their friends and riding partners as well.
How about youth? What kinds of unique risks do young people face riding ATVs, and how do you work with young people to keep them safe?
That's a great question. One of the biggest problems we have is underage or undersized kids on a machine that's too big for them, and they don't have the experience. We've been partnering up with the Ride Safe Foundation, which is a national organization, going into school systems, spending a day or two with literally thousands of kids to talk about what we call five red flag warnings, you know, the size of machine, get training, don't ride on roads, you know, when you're younger and you're not eligible, wearing the right gear, that kind of stuff. So it's a multiple approach. It's crazy how many kids don't know the basics.
Hmm. I want to talk about alcohol for a moment. The public health tracking data, it says, you know, people in Wisconsin drink more alcohol than in most other states. some of these fatal accidents involve alcohol. Does ATV, UTV culture in Wisconsin involve drinking alcohol? What is your organization doing on this front?
Yeah, some of that, you know, I guess the reputation I hear and see is that, you know, the trails, like snowmobiles go bar to bar. Well, it's not necessarily tavern, but where we're riding out in the woods, there aren't many other businesses. And as we know up north, some of the places they serve alcohol, they serve food, their grocery store, their post office. So it doesn't mean that people are necessarily drinking when they're in there, but there are certainly cases, as Jake mentioned, where people unfortunately do drink and they shouldn't be during and before they go riding. So we have really been focusing on that a lot as to how to get people to want to change their habits on that. And it seems like it's, you know, it's in automobiles, it's in boating, it's in snowmobile, ATV. We all have that same issue. It's I hate to say it's a Wisconsin problem, but it is.
Randy, as we close here, you know, people born before 1988, they are not required to take a safety course for ATV operation. Would your organization, would you support requiring everyone to take a safety course to operate one of these vehicles?
We're actually working on some concept legislation right now, and we're differentiating between road routes and trails. Mm-hmm. And trails are one aspect we need to focus on, and the 1988 date seems to work for that. But we have a significant number of road routes, over 65,000 miles of road routes. It's about 60% of the roads. So we're working together to come up with a plan to stabilize, I guess I would say, the criteria needed to operate on road routes. We're hopeful we can get that through.
Randy, thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for helping spread the word.
Randy Hardin is president of the Wisconsin ATV-UTV Association, talking about his organization's efforts to educate riders on safety to prevent fatal crashes. Earlier, we heard from Jake Holzclaw, conservation warden with the Wisconsin DNR, overseeing the off-highway vehicle program.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, Wisconsin forests play a big role in the state's economy and ecosystems. Meet forest managers trying to preserve them for generations to come.
We're looking at management techniques that, you know, maybe we carry out this year and we really won't see the effects or how it went for 30, 40, 50, 100 years from now.
Cultivating healthy forests, that's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin is home to about 16 million acres of forest.
Most of Wisconsin's trees are considered relatively young since they were planted after the cutover period of the late 19th century, which nearly eradicated certain species, like the white pine.
Now the state's forests face new threats brought on by climate change and invasive species.
Oak trees are declining due to spongy moth, and ash trees throughout the state are under threat from the emerald ash borer.
And wind events like this year's tornadoes can blow down trees that may have been growing for more than a century, leaving the forest damaged and more susceptible to disease.
Later, we'll hear from tribal foresters working in northeastern Wisconsin, where Menominee Tribal Enterprises, or MTE, oversees the Menominee Forest.
First, trees are also a big part of the state's economy. Forest products are the second biggest industry output in Wisconsin. Harry Schinnebeck is executive director of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association based in Rhinelander. Before that, he was self-employed as a third-generation logger and trucker for more than 30 years. Henry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Happy to be here.
Now, we got about 16 million plus or minus acres of forests around Wisconsin. Big picture, how important are all these trees to the state's ecosystem and economy?
Well, it's, you know, as you know, the forest industry is the number two industry in the state of Wisconsin. And for us, trees are extremely valuable, extremely important. You know, I think it's cool that we've never run out of trees and never will. And that's part of our mission, is to make sure that we never run out of trees. A lot of our members are third, fourth, fifth, even getting into sixth generation now of forest management. And I would say that Wisconsin I would put our forest up against anybody in the world as far as being sustainable and well managed. You know, we're no longer in the 1900s. We've learned a lot since then, and you know, everything revolves around the trees. It's the recreation we have, the wildlife habitat, clean air, clean water, all the things that we enjoy as a society. In addition, and the way that we make that happen and keep our forest healthy is through forest management.
Yeah, that forest management concept, people might think, hey, forests, they're natural. Let's just let them all grow, right? And we don't need to intervene. What is happening in forest management that you see is key to maintaining healthy forests for the state?
You know, we've got a lot of certification systems. We've got Sustainable Forestry Initiative. We have Forest Stewardship Council certification, those kinds of things. And that's kind of a check and balance that we use for our, you know, as part of our association. We do all of the SFI training for loggers. And that means that if you wanted to become a logger, you're going to have to first learn about best management practices for water quality, endangered species, invasive species, areas of high conservation value. You're going to need to know all those things before you start going out and doing forest management. And all of our forest management has a plan. Everything we do has a plan behind it. And, you know, again, we want to make sure that we keep the forest healthy, because that provides all those other services. And having a vibrant industry, we're very fortunate in this part of the country that we still have industry left that can absorb the wood that we're growing. It's like your garden. You have to, you know, you have to take care of it. You have to weed it out, so to speak. And we're always looking to grow higher value trees. And people are very dependent on forest products, whether they realize it or not, because it's in a lot of products, not only lumber for houses and windows and those kinds of things, but there's ice cream sweeteners, there's cardboard that has your Culver's hamburger in it, there's paper. There's just so many products. We've learned so much as far as, you know, how we can utilize all those products and how we can use every bit of the tree to help us have a better life.
Now, in that management, what are some of the worries? What are some of the bad things that can happen, as you see it, if we aren't doing some selective, sustainable harvesting of wood?
Well, the forest becomes overcrowded. You know, I know that you have some of your guests on. MTE is a awesome example of forest management, the way they've done it, starting back with Chief Oshkosh. And I think a lot of us have learned from that. But we have to take care of the forest. We need to take out, you know, we have a lot of invasive species now, like oak wilt, heterobasidian root rot, Dutch elm disease, those kinds of things. And we very rarely can stop them, but we can certainly mitigate their spread by doing proper forest management and having times of the year when we can manage certain species and when we don't manage certain species to control their spread.
You mentioned the paper industry, still important in Wisconsin, but many communities know they've lost their paper mills in the last couple decades. How has that impacted the forest industry in the state?
Well, what we're seeing right now, according to forest inventory analysis, and that's kind of a longstanding measurement of how many trees we're growing, we're actually seeing that our natural mortality is exceeding harvest rates, and that's not a good thing. Some natural mortality is good, but if that continues, if we continue to lose markets and forest health starts declining even more than it is, we have a very good potential for more fires, because nature will take care of itself.
Henry, thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
That was Henry Schinnenbeck, Executive Director of the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association, based in Rhinelander. We've been talking about challenges to maintaining Wisconsin forests and why the health of trees matters for the environment and the state's economy. Now we head to northeastern Wisconsin, where tribes have been at the forefront of sustainable forestry practices. Chris Caldwell is president of the College of Menominee Nation, and Paul Cole is forest manager for the Stockridge Muncie community. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hi, thanks for having us.
And Chris, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, good to be here, Rob.
Chris, the Menominee Forest, it's a one-of-a-kind in Wisconsin, maybe the world. What makes this forest unique?
Oh, man. I would say a lot of things in describing it, but mostly that we as a people, Menominee people, continue to maintain our relationship with the forest. And so it's carried us through a lot of different times and changes prior to contact, through contact, European contact, American settler periods, and even now as we derive a living from it within our communities.
And Paul, you oversee a younger forest just southwest of the Menominee Reservation. What does forestry management look like for the Stockbridge Muncie tribe?
The forest management here in the Stockbridge Muncie community is pretty important and pretty ingrained into the community. Management here is pretty typical of northern Wisconsin across jurisdictional boundaries kind of thing. So just doing basic things, ecological management across the landscape, trying to make a healthy, resilient forest for the future.
And Chris, the Menominee Nation, known for its sustainable forestry processes. Henry mentioned it, actually. Tell us a little bit about your tribe's approach to managing the forest.
Yeah, so my just kind of context, my background is in forestry, but I currently serve as president of the College of Menominee Nation. But, you know, that's a pretty close connection in terms of the type of work we do here. It's future forward thinking, taking care of our trees, taking care of our students. I see it as one in the same, just different acronyms and other things we use to accomplish it. But when it comes to the Menominee Forest, we've always approached it as a relational thing. So we as a people have a responsibility to the forest, because we know if we take care of it, it will take care of us. And when I say that, that relation has carried from pre-contact to present day, that relationship is always there, but it's just changing in terms of how we go about doing that. And it extends from, like previously was mentioned, Chief Oshkosh, the management philosophy he expressed of starting in the rising sun, cutting to the setting sun, and when you reach the end, start over again, cutting only the mature, sick, and down trees. And that way the trees will last forever. And so that philosophy carries a Menominee worldview that continues, and it actually shapes how we determine what modern silvicultural techniques or GIS mapping tools or other things that we, that our Menominee Tribal Enterprises brings in to carry out the operational management of the forest. So that connected philosophy operation is an extension of our people's responsibility that we carry.
Paul, what are the top challenges you're facing now when it comes to managing the forest?
Top challenges, man, there's so many right now. I think one of the big ones that we've been fighting the last few years or really working hard on is invasive species. They're coming in from all sides, and whether it's invasive shrubs or herbs or insects or diseases, we're constantly finding new ones and trying to deal with them so that the trees have all the resources they need to succeed. So that's a huge one. The other one is shift in how the climate and the weather is working. So, you know, we're seeing wind events that are far more extreme and more frequent than we've had in the past. And that's been a huge deal. I mean, the forests of northern Wisconsin and in the Midwest are the basic disturbance regime is wind events. So our forests are very adapted to this, but the frequency and the intensity has seemed to change over the last few decades. So, you know, as much as we'd like to be doing our normal management techniques, a lot of times we seem to be just chasing storms and fighting invasives.
And Paul, is there kind of a compounding effect where a forest that's suffering from invasive species might be more vulnerable to wind, trees damaged by wind might be more vulnerable to invasive species?
Absolutely. They can definitely compound. I mean, some of the big parts of getting in and dealing with wind events and damaged trees like that is, you know, invasive species are going to take over those sites that are disturbed, or insects are going to get in and really, you know, build up populations in that wounded wood or in that damaged timber. So you can get some really big spikes in insects. You can really introduce a lot of invasive species when you have events like that, or vice versa. So yeah, they compound a lot.
On the cultural side of things, we recently spoke with Red Cliff elder Marvin Defoe, who is a master birch bark canoe builder. Here's some of what he had to say.
It's getting harder and harder today, gathering the materials for the canoe. These last 2 years have been very difficult gathering birch bark. Because the birch trees are dying, the climate is changing, the trees are dying, and it's getting very difficult.
Chris, what kind of impact would a loss of trees have on Menominee culture and traditions?
Yeah, just to kind of point to one thing is that at Menominee, one of the primary strategic forestry goals has been maintaining the diversity of native species and habitats. And that's always been described as the strength of the forest. And so if you have those compounding effects like climate and invasives that, like garlic mustard, that take over whole plant communities, replace them, you know, you start reducing the level of diversity present and thereby reducing the strength of the forest overall. But when it comes to individual species of trees or plants that are used for cultural and medicinal activities, it can range from just like the elder said, that it makes it harder to find good material to make things like birch bark canoes, or in the case of emerald ash borer, where it's starting to decimate the white ash trees that our basket makers use, it creates a requirement to, and what Menominee is doing is seed saving, but also cutting ash trees to store for future use for basket making, and then even processing some of that just so, you know, we have the materials on hand while we try to figure out how will we access those materials in the future. And others are like maple sugar season is kind of in flux. It doesn't always happen around when people expect it. And that's also could be an indicator of an impact on our language. So as we seek to reclaim our language, it's based on observance of natural processes and timing of seasons. And so if those start changing, then the question is, what do you do with the language? Change it to reflect what we see today? Or does that become such a rapid change, we have to think about how to phrase uncertainty and climate change and other concepts like that into language revitalization? So they're pretty complex, just across forest management and social and cultural activities.
Paul, I want to ask about the timeline here. Trees don't grow on human command. The hardwood can be, you know, over a century to grow to where you could harvest it. What does thinking along those timelines do to shape your work as a forester?
Trees don't live in the same time frame as us. So it's very difficult sometimes to talk about, because, you know, we're looking at management techniques that, you know, maybe we carry out this year, and we really won't see the effects or how it went for 30, 40, 50, 100 years from now. So it's a really big picture thing, and we have to use a lot of historic knowledge and science behind it that says, hey, you know, this happened before with these new constraints of climate change or invasive species. We expect this to happen. And, you know, we use models and a lot of things like that, too. But looking at the big long time scale is very important. It also can be very difficult when you're trying to explain this to maybe somebody that's not as familiar with forestry and forestry practices. Is, you know, it takes a lot longer than us, and we want to see things very quickly, and the forest doesn't really care.
That's interesting. And Chris, with that in mind, at the College of Menominee Nation, you're working with young people and introducing them to some of these concepts. What are you seeing as you bring up the next generation of forest managers?
Yeah, definitely. Looking for ways and strategies for showing the next generation of leaders and foresters and practitioners that it's not just a job you clock into. There is that cultural connection. So there's a deeper sense of responsibility beyond just, you know, putting in your hours on the job. But there's a lot of intrinsic value that's carried with, you know, whether it's a tribal member working on the forest or at the sawmill, supporting the forest, sustainable forestry goals and operations, or even if it's someone not from Menominee working for us on the forest, it's helping all of those people to understand that importance. And so our partnership between the college and Menominee Tribal Enterprises seeks to not just help them develop their workforce, but ensure that they're technically sound, that they understand the cultural importance of the work being done, and that they are able to develop in that manner so that, you know, the work we do today continues far into the future, like Paul was saying.
Paul, thanks again for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And Chris, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
That was Paul Cole, forest manager for the Stockbridge Muncie community, and Chris Caldwell, president of the College of Menominee Nation. Earlier, we heard from Henry Schinnebeck from the Great Lakes Timber Professionals Association. They talk about recent challenges to sustainable forest management practices, why the health of trees is important for Wisconsin's environment, culture, and economy.
Coming up, thousands of volunteers pitch in with cleanup after the devastating tornado hit Menasha late last month. Get an update on the response.
I'm so sad that this tragedy happened, but it gave me a chance to see really what our community is made of and how people step up for each other.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The city of Menasha is still recovering from the EF3 tornado that ripped through the region on July 27th. But the community is stepping up to support each other in the aftermath.
Organizations around the Fox Cities have held fundraising events and other volunteer efforts to help the thousands of people who had their homes and businesses damaged by the storms.
From Menasha Strong t-shirts to Kringles for a Cause, local organizers have raised tens of thousands of dollars at a time, in addition to the thousands of volunteer hours that help distribute supplies and clean up debris.
We're checking in on the recovery efforts in Menasha to see how a community is banded together in the wake of devastating storms.
Julie Llewellyn is an Appleton resident who's helping return family heirlooms and photos that were lost in the storm. The project she's doing with her friend, Fran Armstrong, is called Weathered, Not Lost. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kate. I'm happy to be here.
How did you experience this tornado when it ripped through Menasha?
Luckily, I didn't experience much other than the rain. I was not in the path, but I did previously live on Doty Island, mm-hmm. where there's significant damage, and still have a lot of friends there, and this is my community.
This is your community, which I would imagine compelled you to want to help in some way. Is that right?
Yes. And as you know, there's lots of help out there. So I wanted to do something that wasn't giving them another Facebook page to look at or how am I going to reach out? I wanted to do something specific, and photos and sentimental items came to mind. So that's how that started.
Can you talk about what you're trying to do with your weathered, not lost bins in Menasha? What have you set up?
Yes, well, we have two collection sites for photos or anything else, like I said, of sentimental value. One is in Onup Street and the other is in De Pere Street, both in Menasha. One's a little bit closer to Nina than the other. And they're just totes that are outside of businesses that we're asking people to drop off photos if they haven't already found the owner. Along with that, Fran Armstrong is working with me on this, and she has offered to try and reformat the photos so that they're more clear. A lot of them that we're receiving, of course, are weather damaged. Some of them is very hard to tell who or what is in it. So Fran is working on that, and then hopefully in the next couple of weeks, I'll open up my office and have people come in and collect their photos. We're also doing them digitally for those that are being corrected. So they'll have the hard copy of their original and then the reformatted photo.
What kind of items and pictures have you come across so far in these bins?
Well, we have found school pictures, we have found baby pictures, family pictures, commencement pamphlet that we've received, and some writings, like letter type of things. Now, again, they're very hard to read, and it's strange, but there's insulation and all other particles all over some of these things. So it's handled with care.
And Julie, you're in the early efforts here because debris removal is ongoing. I would imagine there will be other lost items and photos that come your way. Do you anticipate continuing this effort for a while?
Yes, that's my hope too. Exactly. The big trees are now being removed. People are raking or done raking, but they have so many things to go through even in their homes. And they might find some things that maybe they want Fran to work on, and she has offered to do that. So I'm hopeful that we will have others and can help people just have those sentimental pictures back. In this digital age, there may not be as many, but I know that I have pictures from my parents and grandparents that were precious to me if they were to be lost. So I hope we can find some and bring them back to the people.
How does this bring you closer to your community?
I just feel like it's very personal to have that photo and to be able to give it back to them.
Julie, thank you for sharing this. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Julie Llewellyn of Appleton is helping return family heirlooms and photos that were lost in the tornado that hit Menasha on July 27th. We're learning more about the recovery efforts in the city and how the community is coming together to rebuild. Carolyn DeRosier is CEO of Volunteer Fox Cities, which is helping coordinate the volunteer response to cleanup and rebuilding in Menasha. Carolyn, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What have you seen in volunteerism? I know thousands of people. There was an outpouring at the beginning. What have you learned about volunteerism in the area?
Gosh, I've learned so many things. I've learned that this community shows up when help is needed. I've learned that people can become leaders in an instant. There were a lot of, early on especially, times where we were trying to organize groups to go out into the community, and we needed team leaders. We needed people with supervisor experiences. We needed traffic managers. And people just stepped up. When we said, who has this type of experience? Who can help with this? People stepped up and took it on, and in some cases stayed for days at the volunteer reception center to become a leader of that section or of that job. And I was just so impressed by that in particular. It was an unforgettable experience. I'm so sad that this tragedy happened, but it gave me a chance to see really what our community is made of and how people step up for each other.
Where is the volunteerism focus now? Where does it stand?
Yeah, so it's been quite a big shift. In the initial days after the disaster, we were organizing mass groups of people to go out and to do cleanup or to do canvassing door to door to make sure that residents of the affected areas had their needs met. But now a lot of the work that needs to be done on properties needs to be done by contractors. People are waiting for insurance. So we've slowed down on those mass cleanup efforts and moved to more targeted projects. For example, we had a team from a local company out last Thursday helping former Menasha Mayor Don Merkis with some gardening. The Marigold Mile in Menasha is a big point of pride. It's a mile of marigolds downtown, and it had been neglected over the weeks since the tornado. It makes perfect sense, but it was something volunteers could help with and something that could restore a little bit of that community pride, a little bit of that hope. So we're still working on projects like that, matching wherever we can with whatever the project need is that we hear from emergency management or the affected communities with a volunteer group that can help.
Carolyn, are you needing specialized volunteers now, volunteers that have either specific equipment or specific skill sets?
We're not in need of volunteers with heavy equipment or specialized skills at this time that I'm aware of. Really, we take our cues from emergency management, and that's not something they've been reaching out with. However, I will say many of our nonprofits that are on the front lines of responding and our emergency management professionals are starting to reach out to ask if we have people with administrative skills, web design skills. There's a lot of other skill sets that I think are needed. So especially for our corporate partners, there's opportunity to donate some of their time, for their employees to donate time in different ways, more behind the scenes ways that are going to help the overall recovery effort.
Carolyn, in closing, this, of course, as you mentioned at the outset, it's a tragedy, but do you think volunteerism has reached like a new point in the region? Opening up new avenues for the community?
I do believe that it is. I've been a fan and an advocate of volunteerism, obviously, before this disaster happened, and I'm now even more so. It brought people together. It gave people a sense of purpose. We had so many people share stories about how they came to volunteer alone, and then they made friends by the end of the day. And my hope is that the thousands of people that came to volunteer after the tornado remember what that felt like, and they keep looking for those volunteer opportunities because our community still needs them. And it's just going to benefit everyone, the volunteers themselves, as well as the organizations and the communities that they're helping.
Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Carolyn DeRosier is CEO of Volunteer at Fox Cities, the local nonprofit helping coordinate volunteer efforts to clean up and rebuilding in Menasha. She was with us to share what local volunteers have accomplished in the city and what needs still remain. We're getting a roundup of the recovery efforts in Menasha with local leaders coordinating the response. Lisa Kogan-Praska is president and CEO of United Way Fox Cities, and Kurt Datejen is president and CEO of the Community Foundation for the Fox Valley Region. Lisa and Kurt, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Kurt, can you give us a bit of a range of the types of local fundraising efforts you've seen around the Menasha area?
Well, a disaster on this scale mobilizes everyone to try to do what they can to help. And we have seen donations large and small. It's corporate contributions, it's individuals making contributions, and the response has just been overwhelming. And the coordination and the collaboration amongst everyone who wants to help is just making our community that much better.
Lisa, what do you notice about the coordination and collaboration and the results so far of this tornado relief fund?
Honestly, it's like something I've never seen before. It's amazing to see how many people are reaching out, how many people want to help. They want to give of their time, their talent, their treasure, whatever it is that they can do to help to make a difference. I think everyone feels impacted. Even if their home was not impacted directly, they see this happening in our community. And so we have seen everything from, as Kurt touched on, large corporate donations and individual donors to kids doing lemonade stands, right? To see and trying to make a difference and pulling that together. So it's been incredible to see really the depth and the breadth of the giving across our community.
Where do numbers stand right now in terms of fundraising? What is the latest?
With our collaborative efforts, we've raised a few million dollars already. And when you combine that with the corporate contributions and pledges that have already been declared, you know, we're in the 15 million plus from a community response perspective. Our organizations are deploying grants to the nonprofits that are on the front lines really helping people. And that's the breadth of the support that we're able to provide. The next step is really to mobilize the dollars going directly to the individuals and households affected. Insurance is only going to go so far, and people in some cases have lost literally everything, and their lives have to be rebuilt. And that's where the community response is next going to show up. It's for the people.
Lisa, can you talk a bit about how that community response will unfold and how local households, how families will be supported in the weeks to come?
Certainly. So as Kurt had touched on, you know, in the very early days, we really tried to deploy those dollars to nonprofits to go out and do some of that just kind of crisis response, making sure that people had food and water and tarps for their roofs and those types of things. The next phase that we're entering now is really about immediate needs. So focusing on some of those short-term immediate financial needs that we know families are having, and we're getting ready to create the infrastructure to be able to get that out quickly and efficiently to the families. And then the next phase after that is really about long-term recovery, because once you have the time to go through and understand what is insurance going to be, if there's FEMA, what is that going to cover? We know that there's still going to be unmet needs for many people. So then looking at what's that structure to really provide that coordination and that case management to make sure that those unmet needs continue to be met as we move through this.
Kurt, you mentioned businesses really stepping up, as well as just, you know, local people giving their time, giving their money. How much support has come from outside of the city of Menasha?
It's been amazing to see. Just before this phone call, I opened up a FedEx package, and there was a check from a corporation that has a presence here in the community, not in Menasha, but in the region. But the corporate headquarters is elsewhere, and it was a check for $100,000. And it was, we've had a long presence there. We want to help. Thank you for being a partner and helping us to do something about this. The donations have literally been coming in from all over. Certainly the state of Wisconsin, and in some cases outside the state of Wisconsin. But this is really a very impactful and deep hit on our community. People get that, and all you have to do is take a look at the pictures and the images, and it pulls on people's heartstrings, and they say, gosh, that could have happened to us. It could have happened in my community. So people are mobilized, and people in the Midwest really do care, and we appreciate all their generosity.
How much of a challenge is time here in being able to collect these dollars, but then turn them really quickly in the way they can make the greatest impact? Can you talk about that conversion?
We have a committee, a cross-sector committee, that meets twice a week to understand, review applications, review needs, and make those grants as close in real time as we can to get those dollars flowing. And now with this next phase of the work, really looking at how do we do that financial assistance, but also understand that there is going to be longer term needs. So we have to balance that need to get those dollars out quickly with also understanding so that we can make sure that we're using those dollars as effectively as possible.
Well, Kurt and Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
We appreciate you getting the word out for us. We really appreciate it a lot.
Thank you so much for having us.
Lisa Kogan-Praska is president and CEO of United Way Fox Cities, and Kurt Dajcin leads the Community Foundation for the Fox Valley region. They shared how fundraising in Menasha is helping support the community's recovery from the tornado that hit on July 27th. Earlier, we heard from Julie Llewellyn and Carolyn DeRosier. We just heard how community members are lending a hand in Menasha and reuniting residents with photos that may have been swept away in tornado debris.
Do you have a story to share about a photo or family heirloom being lost and then found? Maybe you lost a treasured photo in the Menasha tornado or other devastating storm. Could you share your story and what that photo means to you? Also, how do you preserve old family photos to pass them on to the next generation?
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. Again, the number 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Rochelle Wilson, and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.